Welcome to the Washington Updates podcast from the National Association of Health Underwriters. This podcast is being recorded on Thursday afternoon, shortly after the Trump administration released new guidance on the expansion of association health plans. This guidance comes on the heels of a year that began with a promise of sweeping changes in federal policy and closed with the largest overhaul of the nation's tax code in more than 30 years. Marcy Buckner, John Green, and Chris Hartman join us on this week's installment to discuss what has changed and what is to come in the year ahead. The Trump administration released new guidance today on the expansion of association health plans. What was in this guidance and how is NAHU working to influence its final version?
So this morning, again, we're recording on Thursday afternoon. This morning, the Trump administration from the Department of Labor released their proposed rule changing or expanding association health plans. And this stems from the Trump administration's executive order from October asking agencies to do everything in their power to help increase competition, lower premiums. And one of those pieces was in regards to expanding the AHPs or association health plans. And so we've been expecting this for quite some time. It finally came out this morning. There is a 60-day comment period, and NEHU will be providing comments and working with a number of our members who work with association health plans as they are structured now to comment on the way that this rule will be going. So it was really interesting because this is 83 pages. Only six of them are the actual rule, and the rest are background and information leading up to the actual proposed rule of how the regulation would be worded if it goes into place. So there is a lot of thought put behind this and a lot of different areas of concern that I think our members and others in the industry have about association health plans. So I'm going to kind of open it up to Chris and John on different topics within the association health plans that you have questions about that were mentioned in the proposed rule.
So Marcy, can any association now just start offering healthcare to any of its memberships? For example, could NAHU decide now we're going to offer our own healthcare plan to members of NAHU?
There are some restrictions on how the association health plans work and what can be considered an association under association health plans. One piece that was removed under this proposed rule is the restriction that an association cannot be formed just to offer insurance. That means that this is different than what happened before. Before, there was the rule that you can't just create an association just because you want to do an AHP.
Does now, that mean a Marcy Buckner association could be started tomorrow and you could start, people could join just to get healthcare from you?
I could start it, but the people who could join also have to follow different rules. So they either have to be all in the same industry or trade. So they'd have to be, in this instance, probably health insurance agents and brokers, since that's what we do here at NAHU. Or they have to be in the same principal place of business. And so that's where we get into some intricacies when we're talking about location and when we're talking about the administration's attempt at trying to get to selling across state lines through the association health plans.
So legislation in the past has always required this bona fide requirement that it be for other purposes other than insurance. I think this is one of the most significant departures from the past.
Right. The proposed rule starts off with saying that the main piece here is that they are changing the definition of what a bona fide employer is in order to make this change to the ERISA law to allow for more groups to qualify to be part of an association health plan. And then when we look at selling across state lines, this gets into that locale of being in the same principal place of business. And that is a legal term that we use a lot, principal place of business. And there's a lot that goes into proving that. But with that, they specifically say that it's within the same state or within the same metropolitan area. So it recognizes areas like Washington, D.C., where many of you have come here for Capitol Conference, and you probably realize that D.C., Maryland, and Virginia really overlap a lot. It also recognizes areas like New York, the greater New York City area, overlapping with parts of New Jersey, possibly Connecticut and other areas. And it says that one of the comments that they're soliciting is looking at ways that they can define that more specifically when looking at metropolitan areas so that they can be more specific to make sure that this doesn't go even broader with outside of that, so that you're selling from New York to California. That's not the attempt here. It's that if you're in the same principal place of business, you're in the same area, even if it happens to go across state lines. But if you're going across state lines, you're going to have to still follow the rules of both of those states.
The appeal of AHPs really gets to western states where the ranchers and farmers who are desperate for coverage, and there aren't many of them around, right?
That is one of the pieces. They specifically mention farmers in this, and in, I believe, a press statement that was released by the administration mentions the farmers and also small businesses that see this as a benefit of being able to get into an association health plan because they are usually smaller than 50 people that are in those types of working environments, and being able to trade into this association health plan. In that example, it would be, they would probably be going in because they're all in this, all farmers together, the same industry, and being able to use that in a way to make up a large group and to be able to benefit from those large group rules instead of with some of those farmers trying to get in through the individual market, which might be financially exclusive for them.
Now, Marcy, you talked a little bit about DC being very close to Maryland and Virginia and trying to define that as one metropolitan area. Now, that association you're starting, would you actually have to stick with one subject matter, or could it just be the Marcy Buckner of Washington, greater DC area, now offering healthcare?
It is an and or that you have to be with the same industry or trade or the same principal place of business, being the same state or within the same metropolitan area. So it's an and or with those requirements. So
but who has oversight?
They will have oversight. And that's one of the things they're asking about is how exactly can do we restrict this? How do we define that? So when I mentioned that only 6 pages of the 83 pages is the actual language of what would be a rule, the actual change in the law, the 77 pages leading up to it is not only background, but it's also comments like that saying, how can we define what a metropolitan area is? Is it saying specific zip codes? Is it giving a mileage radius from a center point? How do we say what's the same trade? Is a farmer and a rancher, are they going to be the same thing? How do we define these differences and put them together? And as someone who's not a farmer or a rancher, I hope I didn't offend anyone by saying that they are the same or not. You know, those types of things. So they're asking for comments. And those are some of the things that we'll be talking about when we get back to them with our input.
Would these new trade associations, or the new Marcy Buckner Association you'll start, will you be able to decide who can join your association or not based on their health status?
You cannot based on their health status. So there are a lot of non-discrimination rules that are kept within this and how they can determine who joins their association health plan. And one piece is looking at health status. And that is something that I would not be able to do if I was creating an association health plan and bringing employers in. If I knew that an employer was coming to me and they had a lot of issues with health in their employee background, I would not be able to preclude them from joining just based on that.
Another complexity I see is relative to self-insured AHPs.
So that is a whole other piece here. And it's really interesting when you're going through some of the comments that they provided before the rule, outlining really a lot of the challenges that have faced association health plans as they currently are structured. Because in the past or currently, those that are joining the association health plans will either qualify on their own as an individual, small or large group based on the independent employer's status. And in this case, they're trying to bring them all together. So if all of the employees together in the association health plan are less than 50, it'll be a small group, but with more likelihood that they'll all be a large group. There's also the ability that they can all come together and become a self-insured group. And with this, the thought process behind it is that this is a better financial protection for those that want to be self-insured because you're bringing more folks into the realm. And there's also a better financial protection of being able to afford a better stop-loss insurance procedures and things like that.
So a lot of small business owners are self-employed, groups of one, and right now they have to go in the individual market. Would they now be able to join your association?
They would. So this is one of the most groundbreaking pieces, I think, that's in this proposed rule when we're looking at it, and also kind of hedges on some of our concerns about this rule. So as we've been talking about association health plans along the way, our concern always when we were expecting this proposed rule was that it was going to allow individuals in, and this could cause a huge adverse selection problem. So when we saw that this rule was being delegated over to the Department of Labor, we were feeling very positive that because it was at the Department of Labor, it would be overseeing things, the ERISA-sponsored plans, and so they would be only employer-sponsored plans, so these would be groups. But then we got this proposed rule out, and it allowed for groups of one as a sole proprietor or owner of a business to join in for an association health plan. So I think in some instances where we've heard from our members that they've had trouble with husband and wife groups and things like that, that have been precluded from going into the small group market, that will help them. But it doesn't ease our concerns about having individuals coming in to the association health plan market and joining into the group plan market and changing that risk assessment that's there between the two markets.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the risk profile ends up being, if a carrier will even want to venture into taking all these, quote, sole proprietors who self-attest that they are a sole proprietor in order to get into one of these arrangements and what it does to their risk profile.
And I do picture them not having an association health plan that's all sole proprietors, but as an association health plan taking a combination of individuals that are sole proprietors, small groups, and possibly large groups that want to come in and forming a larger association health plan. It's kind of how I envision it, but that's not to say that there might be someone else out there that sees a purpose in creating an association health plan just for those groups of one. So just as a reminder, number one, Chris was only using the Marcy Buckner Association Health Plan as an example. I am not creating my own AHP.
Although I think you were more than qualified to do it.
Why, thank you. And NEHU in general has always been just very cautious about the structures of AHPs, and again, being concerned about the adverse selection in the group market and trying to protect that. So we are going to be going through the rest of this rule and subsequent pieces that come out from the administration and submitting comments. Again, it's a 60-day comment period, so we'll be into March before our comments go out. This is just a proposed rule. None of this is final yet, and we will keep you updated as we hear anything else from the administration.
This guidance was initiated from President Trump's executive order issued in October. What other items are in process from that directive, and how else is the administration seeking to reshape healthcare through the regulatory process?
We still have, specifically from Trump's executive order, two other issues that we are waiting for resolution on. And so we have the association health plan piece that we just discussed. We're also looking for more possibly on health reimbursement accounts. We have been told that the quasi-HRAs or the QSC-HRAs, the guidance that we received on that may not be all of what we're getting from the HRAs that could be changed as a result of the executive order. So we're still waiting on more from that from Treasury. And then also looking at the short-term limited duration plans, there has been a lot of interest there on exactly how those are implementing the market and whether the changes to the limits on short-term limited duration plans that the Trump administration is seeking is actually going to be something that resolves that. So those are two pieces specifically from the executive order that are still kind of pending.
I think part of what also people are looking at with the executive order is evolving out of it, not including the AHPs or HRAs, is a request for information about other ways of creating flexibility and competition into the health insurance market. So HHS has put out a request for information about what other sort of changes we want to see from the regulatory side. One piece NEHU is going to work very hard on this request for information is related to the medical loss ratio, and that the effect that the medical loss ratio is having on bringing competition and choice to the insurance market, and the effect that the medical loss ratio is having on broker commissions. Broker commissions being included onto the medical loss ratio, even though brokers do not work for the insurance carriers, and so shouldn't be counted as part of their administrative costs. And I think one of the things that we've really seen is with carriers not being able to offer much in the way of broker commissions, it's really hard for an insurance carrier to move into a new market and begin offering an insurance plan if they don't have the resources, because of the medical loss ratio, to offer brokers commissions when they come into a new market. So right now we're really seeing the effect of the medical loss ratio limiting competition and choice within the insurance market, and we're going to be sure to comment on that in, with the request for information that's out there.
The last time we talked, the tax reform bill had yet to be passed and signed into law. Can you give us a brief overview of what was in it as it relates to health insurance and what NAHU members should be telling their clients?
So I think the most important thing is related to the individual mandate, and it zeroes out the penalty for the individual mandate. But it's important to note, particularly in the profession of agent brokers, that this is for the year 2019. So for the year right now, 2018, if you drop your healthcare coverage, say in February, you will face a tax penalty for not being covered for the remainder of the year. So sometimes the media and others make what just happened to tax law sound like the Obamacare was repealed, which I've seen that headline. But even if you're just seeing the individual mandate repealed, I think it's really important as professionals to know, to advise your clients that that's not till the year 2019. And they could be hit with penalties for this year if they're not covered. The tax reform bill also makes other numerous changes on pass-throughs and corporate tax reform and other things that I'm sure will affect many of your agencies out there. But let me pick one other healthcare related area to talk a little bit about when it comes to the tax reform law, and that is on the medical expense deductibility. Under current law, it has to be 10% of your income in order to have it as being deductible. That was put in by the ACA. The law that was passed now actually lowers that threshold down to 7.5 for the next 2 years. So it will be easier for people to deduct their medical expenses than it has been in the past for at least the next coming 2 years. And it goes back to the 10% margin. But this is a big improvement over where we were seeing things in the original House bill that eliminated this deduction overall. So we're pleased to see that change in the law.
Except for people over 65, because it doesn't apply to them. You have to be under 65.
The next major deadline facing Congress is the budget deadline. NHU is working behind the scenes to include delays of the Cadillac and health insurance taxes into the final deal. How would these work now that we are already into 2018? And what is the long-term outlook for full repeal?
Congress, at the end of last year, passed a short-term continuing resolution to keep the government open through January 19th. Did not include many changes, just really keeping all the agencies, the military, and other things fully funded. Made a short insertion of money for the CHIP program through March 31st. So as opposed to CHIP programs in many states having to start disenrolling kids from insurance programs, at least have a small patch through March 31st. But we're coming up to January 19th very quickly. And two of the big issues, as Dan just pointed out, is the Cadillac tax and the health insurance tax. The Cadillac tax, while it doesn't come into effect until 2020, we all know businesses are starting to plan now, making changes to their plans, possibly raising deductibles in order to prepare for that Cadillac tax coming into place. Furthermore, we don't even have regulations out about what would be exactly in or would be out, and on-site clinics, all these other sorts of particular areas to look at when you're calculating the Cadillac tax. So we've been advocating for obviously a full repeal of the Cadillac tax, but if we can't get that, to see a 2-year delay of the Cadillac tax in the coming times to buy us a little more time to not only work on the regulatory side of things, but also to repeal it completely. And the House has offered a 1-year delay of the Cadillac tax and a 5-year retroactive repeal of the employer mandate. I think that repeal of the employer mandate is something that we're definitely very interested in, but we still need that Cadillac tax piece worked on a little more than 1 year. I think 1 year really only gets us to where we are today, and 2 years would give us a little more time to truly prepare. But I think we'll have a little bit more leverage to get to that 2-year over in the Senate, where both Democrats and Republicans on the Senate side have a much more negative view of the Cadillac tax. And so I think we might have more momentum in seeing that delayed over there. But the pressure has to stay on people, because with Congress understanding the Cadillac tax doesn't come until 2020, they feel like they don't need to deal with it today.
And the reality is our members, you all, are meeting with your clients and planning out exactly how they're going to be doing your employer-sponsored coverage plans through 2020. And you already see and are changing the ways that your plans are structured because of the Cadillac tax going into effect in 2020. The other tax that could be put into play while they revisit this is the health insurance tax. And this is one of those taxes that has been part of the ACA, and we've seen it have temporary repeals for a year, and we've seen it be implemented. And here we're looking at going into 2018, trying to get another year of a repeal on the health insurance tax. And it looked like that was going to happen at the end of 2017. Carriers submitted their plans, however, assuming that it was going to go into place, and we enter 2018 with the HIT tax in place. Right now, what they're looking at doing is if the HIT tax does have a 2018 repeal or delay for the year, going into 2018, having the plans already in place, trying to structure some type of rebate to get those funds back to consumers that paid out the HIT tax sometime throughout the year. So this is going to be, I think, a very, and I think I said this before, a very clunky way of trying to piece this back together, and hopefully a reason why Congress realizes they should have done this before going into the 2018 year, when we're going forward into other plan years and possibly still pursuing a year-by-year delay of the HIT tax. We, of course, are trying to get a full repeal. But this will be, I think, the first year that we go into the actual plan year with the HIT tax continuing, with Congress possibly doing a delay within that same year after the plans have already started.
Yeah, you know, as we were approaching the end of last year, the proposal originally made by the Ways and Means Committee to us was that, look, we're going to delay it in 19, but, you know, 18 is already in place, and so it's sort of a lost year. We're just going to pay it. But you should be really happy that we're going to delay it in 19. And we were like, oh, no, 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 no. We think that you should delay it for 18 and 19, and that, you know, the carriers can figure out a way. But then Treasury got involved, and they had their say, and so we couldn't arrive at a solution to this problem. And while it will be a little bit complicated, we send a man to the moon, we can give people their money back. There's got to be a way to do this in an efficient and reasonable fashion.
Yeah, the HIT tax does nothing but make health insurance more expensive. So anything we can do to return that money to individuals, small businesses, large businesses, seniors on Medicare Advantage, or to that matter, to the states who do have Medicaid programs who also then get taxed, the federal government actually taxes the states for running healthcare, should be done. And so I think that needs to be done immediately and returned back to the taxpayers.
The very controls that Medicaid and states are trying to make by having managed care step in and manage these patients efficiently and in a cost-effective manner is being undermined by this tax.
As we turn the calendar to 2018, we are entering another election year. How does this impact the legislative timetable for the year? Will there be another attempt at healthcare reform as Republicans seek another legislative victory to run on, or are they likely to move on?
I'm going to start with making one other point, and then I'll turn it over to Chris and John to talk specifically about the elections. And this is that other than elections, we do still have some appointed officials that we're waiting for in calendar year 2018 that are still very important. Next week, Alex Azar, the nominee for HHS Secretary, will be going in front of Senate Finance Committee for a confirmation hearing. So we're still waiting for an official Secretary of HHS to be named. We do have an acting secretary now, but this is just one member of the cabinet that we're waiting for. And we have several other appointments that are lower level appointees that we're still waiting for now into 2018 to help us on the regulatory side. And so these aren't even elected officials that we're waiting on. These are appointed officials that we need Congress to act on and the administration to appoint. But those are very important and shouldn't be overlooked. But the 2018 election timetable is also going to be very exciting.
And they do have a great deal of work yet to do. They deferred to 2018, to this year, to act on. And a lot of these issues have absolutely nothing to do with healthcare. Some of them do, but many of them don't. And they're coming up, as Chris said, January 19th. So there's a growing sense that they'll actually do a 1 week or 10-day CR to kick it down a little bit further, to give themselves a little bit more room, because the House is actually not even in session right now. They took extra time off because of what happened at the end of the year. But the Senate is in session because they just, we have two new Democratic senators that have been sworn in, and they're working on judgeships and other things like that. So.
Yeah, so quickly at the beginning of the year, we obviously still have the Children's Health Insurance Program to get in place, a five-year plan. Both Senate Republicans and Democrats have agreed on a five-year plan. We need to pass this. We can't keep playing around with it. A, it destabilizes other insurance markets without this predictability out there. But B, we're talking about children's health care and leaving them vulnerable out there. There are several different Medicare pieces that we're looking at in the new year, and the reimbursements rates for Medicare program that will be out there, and those will all have to be taken care of quickly at the beginning of the year. Paul Ryan has also talked about doing large amounts of entitlement reform, meaning the Medicare and Medicaid programs, and reforming that. I question if that's really possible this year, not only being an election year, but simply taking those things on are huge challenges for anyone. I think Paul Ryan's point is that over the long term in this country, that they're adding to the deficit, and that we can't afford to have these entitlement programs growing at the rates they're growing. So he'll be really looking to tackle entitlement reform in the coming year. At the same time, Paul Ryan was saying this, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, was giving an interview that made it sound like he really didn't want to do any entitlement reform at all in the coming year. And I think he seems to be much more interested in trying to see if there are things that they can get done in a more of a bipartisan basis. As John pointed out, they've gone from a 52-seat to 48-seat majority to a 51-seat to 49-seat majority. So now they can really only afford to lose one vote and pass something with Republicans only. So I think McConnell's looking to pivot. But John's right. There's a lot of stuff that is taking up a lot of the room and energy. Immigration, I think, is going to be huge on the agenda in Washington in the first coming months. Infrastructure is something that President Trump has rightfully spoken about this year. The question is there a deal to be had on it? And when we say infrastructure, how's it going to work? Who's going to pay for it? Where's that money coming from? Where's that money coming from in a world that Paul Ryan's already talked about the coming deficits in the coming months? And I think a lot of Republicans also, now that they have passed tax reform last year, feel that they have an accomplishment under their belt, and they're not really necessarily ready to bite off a very controversial big issue in the coming year. But I do think there's still lots of opportunities when it comes to healthcare on different market stabilizers. Susan Collins is still demanding her vote on the Alexander Murray market stabilization, cost sharing reductions, and 1332 waivers changes, and also on reinsurance. So at some point, I think Mitch McConnell and others are going to look to try to provide what they promised to Susan Collins, and she did vote for the tax reform bill. So I think some of those promises are yet to be played out in the coming year.
Yeah, and once you get past June, kind of think things kind of shut down around here in a midterm year. There won't be a lot of appetite to do two reconciliation bills this year, much less, you know, and we're getting a new budget chairman, which will be determined very shortly because Diane Black is running for governor in Tennessee. And let me say what a heavy lift it was to do the past budget reconciliation bills, as it was to get to do a reconciliation, you know, to set the mark and do all the work that's involved in that. And now you're going to have a new chairman. I just don't see where there's the appetite, even among Republicans, to look at necessarily Medicaid entitlement reform, even if they think that it is philosophically a good thing to do, because they know that they're going to lose the war on words on this going into what will be a very difficult cycle.
Yeah, to Chris's point about riding high after the tax reform victory for Republicans, I think going into the midterm elections, they're going to try to keep that high and those victories very public in order to try to maintain the majorities that they have in the House and the Senate. And whether they're going to be able to do so is something that we'll find out in November later this year.
As John points out, things tend to slow down in June, but I think in June they'll be looking for things that are more bipartisan. I do think more tweaks and changes to Medicare Advantage, making Medicare programs more accessible, notification to employers and employees and how that process works from turning 65, different things around employer reporting and others, things that are less high profile, but as all we know, employer reporting and other issues are pretty real to people who have to actually work on them and do them. I do think those less sort of controversial big ticket items are possible in the later part of the year because we're not talking about as much money. Entitlement reform, we're talking about large amounts of money with having to come up with offsets and other sorts of changes. Some of these more bite-sized manageable issues that aren't as expensive but have the effect, I think will be the sort of stuff that people could be looking towards the end of the year, particularly when they're looking for more bipartisanship, show a few more wins. And Mitch McConnell sounds like he particularly is interested in a more bipartisan approach to the coming year. And the last thing I would not follow up is why I also don't think next year is going to be slow. I actually think next year is going to be even a busier year on the regulatory side. We've already seen association healthcare plans. You have HRAs. You have short-term plans. I think all that is moving 100 miles an hour into the new year. On the regulatory side, I think we're more likely to see that continuing to move on in the new year, particularly now that some of these positions are finally getting filled, as people are finally moving into some of these assistant secretary posts and others that need to be filled in order to change it. I actually think the regulatory side could be even hotter next year than it has been in this past year, as political appointees are starting to be in their positions and really get lay of the land. Remember, we're still without a HHS secretary, but once he's confirmed, I think that's going to speed up the process at HHS even further. And so we could see a lot happening on the regulatory side this coming year.
Well, and I think with the stalemate that we've had in Congress on a lot of things over the past year and even previous to that, there is a lot of focus on the regulatory side and the agencies to be able to get something done because it is a different process with the comment periods and proposed rules and the way that it happens on that side. Much easier to get a federal regulation through than to pass any type of legislation. And the Trump administration is definitely taking advantage of that.
I think fixing the COBRA trap is a good issue for this year because older people and seniors vote. And you know, this is a white hat issue. And I think we have a good chance of getting that one done this year.
We'll add it to the list.
Our thanks to Marcy Buckner, John Green, and Chris Hartman for joining us on this week's podcast for the Washington Update from the National Association of Health Underwriters. Thank you for listening.